Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Today's topic is prescription drug side effects. And before the news, I mentioned new research that uses the internet to identify side effects more effectively. That research, conducted by a team from Stanford and Columbia universities and from Microsoft. And it concluded that analyzing queries on the internet can find evidence of unreported drug side effects faster than the methods now used by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. The FDA relies on reports from doctors, but the new study uses data mining techniques to analyze reports from patients online. The details are in the latest issue of the Journal of the American Medical Informatics Association. We'll be talking about it with an expert on prescription medicines. He is a pharmacist, after all, but Dr. James Rabacki has written extensively about prescription drugs, including in his own books, including The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs and Medicines and Your Family. He's been a frequent guest on Focus over the years. Go to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus and type in Rybacki, R-Y-B-A-C-K-I, and you'll find archived programs featuring Dr. Rybacki going back to 2004. He's here to talk about how the FDA currently tracks drug interactions and negative side effects and how computers might improve the process. And we'll also talk about the testing processes that go into FDA approval and about the differences between adverse effects and prescription side effects. Dr. Rybacki, welcome back to Focus.
Well, it's like coming home as usual. How are you?
I am fine. Of course, I'm not the person you were talking to in all those other shows. David,
I know. Congratulations on your new position and commiserations on your new position.
Well, of course, I'm just the interim host for now. David Inch, who is, I hope, happy in retirement and maybe listening. I don't know how he spends his weekday mornings, but I'm sure you'll be a familiar voice to him. I was wondering, just to get things started, about this study. You're familiar with it? Is it a big deal?
You know, it is a big deal because what we all want, what I want today, in fact, would be a good day because I'm constantly updating books, publications, and my own website at essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com. And the challenge is, how do you get the information in almost real time? And the interesting part about this is you're exactly right. The FDA, trying to do its best, is relying on a voluntary system from doctors, nurse practitioners. And by the way, patients can also report adverse effects via the FDA MedWatch system. Our listeners can go to www.fda.gov. And if you look at that particular site and put in MedWatch, there's actually an 800 number. There's an online form. And if you think you or a loved one has had a problem, you can actually talk to your doctor about this. And there's a very good page in there that the FDA talks about in reporting by consumers. And they realize some people may be somewhat reluctant to talk to Dr. Smith about a drug interaction that they may have prescribed. And so they can actually go to the FDA site and do this on their own. And it's actually relatively easy to do. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-FDA-1088. That's actually 1-800-332-1088. And so there's that system that exists. And if you look at that, over the years, there have been some reports about this and saying, well, you know, if you look at busy practitioners, pharmacists, nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants, and physicians, how are we going to do this? There's been some estimates that only 3 to 17% of serious drug interactions or adverse effects are reported. And it's one of those big challenges in saying, well, I'm really busy. I think I've heard of this before. You know, there's a rash from penicillin. We certainly get that. But it took some really serious drill downs. Dr. Steve Nissen, Cleveland Clinic, for example, looking at Vioxx and how things were working or not working with that particular medicine. And this new approach actually sort of is also used looking at flu trends. And how do you tell when the flu's in the country? Well, Google Flu Trends actually looks at sort of searches for people for side effects of flu or incidence of flu or symptoms of flu. and actually sort of data mines the reports of people and the searches of people once the information that would be a unique identifier is stripped out. And it's actually a really fascinating approach. And it's something that we really desperately need, and I think everybody would love to have earlier access to.
One thing that comes to mind, I guess, is the difference between fast response and the perceived dangers of just anecdotal evidence.
So yeah.
We assume that if a doctor or a pharmacist reports something to the FDA, they've looked at it from a professional point of view and can bring their own knowledge to it and may have seen it in more than a few cases to bring up their concerns.
Sure, and what's the weight of the evidence? Yet there was an article in Pharmacy Practice News in February looking at hospitals too often neglecting drug safety education. That's from the Institute of Safe Medication Practices, or ISMP, who's usually in the middle and does a very good job looking at how medication errors happen and particular drug interactions. And so if we're not educating in general as much as we might in hospitals of practitioners, then there's a little bit of a gap there, and there's a potential, well, geez, I'm really busy, and I don't know, I'm not sure the students have time for this, and well, you know what, they do. And there were some good examples of some VA hospitals that were taking some good and strong approaches looking at how these interactions happen, what report happens. And interestingly, there's also in many hospitals a medication safety leader, a medication safety officer, and that person has the responsibility then of looking at all these potential medication safety problems, adverse effects, and saying, gee, this is something I think we ought to report.
Well, we welcome you to the conversation as well and to join us on the air on Focus with your questions and your experience with prescription medicine side effects. Call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Of course, Dr. Rybacki is a pharmacist, but he's not your pharmacist, so he can't really give you a specific prescription or diagnosis, but you might be able to help with maybe some advice on questions for a patient to ask their doctor about these things.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm wondering, you know, I haven't seen them all, but I don't remember like any of those old Dr. Kildare movies in the 30s having plot lines about adverse side effects or drug interactions. What happened between then and now?
You know, couple things, I think, going way back and looking perhaps in the 50s, probably one of the most tainted medicines, if you will, was a medicine called thalidomide. And this was actually a German product. And the question and what was going to be treated was actually some anxiety and some sleep problems in pregnancy. And the unfortunate adverse effect that as more people started using it came out were birth defects, something called phycomelia. And this really started some, whoa, we've got to look at the benefits versus risks, the adverse effects, and we need to have a stronger system in order to look at, well, gosh, how do we study these medicines? What do we look for in interactions? Should we study more patients? And sort of in the 80s or so, there was a somewhat complicated term called pharmacovigilance, which came up, and I was actually involved with a 52-hospital nationwide group from the Millard Fillmore in Buffalo hospital system called the Drug Surveillance Network. And we looked at some potential adverse effects, some IV to PO switches, and really tried to pull together a network of people thinking about these things in a little bit more organized way. And to the credit of the FDA, they've also looked at a couple different things and looked at what might happen going back to probably 2008 or so. The FDA financed something called the Sentinel Initiative, And it really is a strong effort, I think, to look at risks of medications already in market. And it eventually plans to look at monitor drug use in 100 million people, which is certainly a daunting task, a massive scale. And while there are tons of drug interactions, what we have to remember is that there are degrees of drug interactions, and therein the devil's always in the details.
And I guess that's one thing doctors have to think about, and doctors and pharmacists, is how much reaction is there in this patient? Is it worth it considering the severity of the illness being treated? And just again, the devil is in the details, as you said.
Definitely. And I've always thought of these things as mild possible adverse effects versus serious adverse effects, and wherein lies the difference. The challenge can be, you know, if you look at a pending allergic reaction, say from a penicillin, a somewhat older medicine, well, gee, okay, you're going to start with a little bit of a rash, and as you continue to take that medicine, if you do, that rash is going to get worse, and that can progress to a more serious reaction and can actually impact breathing as you start elaborating more of these inflammatory compounds. And you can actually have an anaphylactic reaction where you may need to be intubated. And it's an example of, well, it's just a little rash. It's probably okay. Well, it's not. You need to talk to your doctor about that. And in general, if you start a new prescription and you notice something happening that doesn't feel normal, it's always okay to call your doctor and pharmacist and say, hey, has this ever been reported? What's going on with this? Very important to catch these things early.
Well, let's go to a caller. We have a caller from Urbana, and I want to say good morning. You're on the air on Focus. You might want to turn your radio down, though.
Hello. I have a question about a particular drug. I don't know if you would have this on the top of your mind. The brand name is Lasix. It's furosemide, a diuretic. And I'm wondering if there's anything. My son is being prescribed it. He's it's a grown son, and he has unfortunately frontotemporal dementia, and this has started to spread to an area that started to affect control of his fluid balance. So he's taking it as a diuretic. I'm wondering if there's anything that we should watch out for.
Sure, and that's an excellent question. Looking at what happens, usually we think of furosemide or Lasix as the brand, as one of those medicines that actually people generally would call a water pill. If you look at the whole series of kinds of diuretics, medicines that actually impact water and help your body remove excess fluid, often used in congestive heart failure, and so your heart isn't pumping quite as well, so fluid tends to accumulate. Other situations, which you mentioned your son has, where you need to try to remove some fluid, works there as well. And the challenge is that, and I've said this often, and I mean this in some sense tongue-in-cheek, medicines are stupid. They don't know that you're just intending to remove water, and they often have other effects. And so when you look at potential side effects and or potential adverse effects, generally an adverse effect is a harmful and undesired effect that comes from a medicine or a procedure like a surgery. And if you look more generally at side effects themselves, they can be either good or bad. But in general, with the water pills, what happens is they have an effect. Hydrochlorothiazide is an earlier one that is not quite as strong, works in a little different way, but it works on the kidney. Furosemide is a loop diuretic. Bumetanide is another example. But what they actually do is help your body get rid of fluid. Unfortunately, you can also lose some sodium with that. And in that same water that's going out, you can also lose some potassium. And in that same water that's going out, you can also lose some magnesium. So what that means is that what the doctors who are following your son, and or anybody who's taking a diuretic, will get what are called electrolytes. And what that means is get a sodium, potassium, chloride. Astutely, they will add a magnesium, and they'll check to make sure that those levels are in the appropriate normal range. And if they're not, they'll replace them. So it's something that requires some ongoing thought and a little bit more laboratory testing. Doesn't mean it's a bad drug, but you got to follow it.
So periodic electrolyte testing would be major safeguard against bad side effects from screwing up the electrolyte balance.
Exactly, and that's something that, again, you have to look with. If there are other medicines that are added that can also cause loss of fluid, loss of electrolytes, and you can have an additive effect, that's something you have to look for. But, yes, in general, those are smart things to look for.
Okay, well, thank you for calling. And about 22 past the hour now, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about prescription medicines and their sometimes unexpected side effects with Dr. James Rabacki, author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, published by Penguin Perigee Books. To join us on the air, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Rabacki, I was thinking that in The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, you have to spend a lot of time looking at side effects.
Oh, without doubt. And what I try to do in the beginning of each of the profiles is actually to look at benefits versus risks. And if you look at the last sort of 1,300-page Essential Guide, which goes back to 2000 risk and 2006, And you look at that benefit to risk, and you happen to look at, we'll use furosemide as an example, what you'd see is a prompt effective diuretic, a modest antihypertensive effect, and may enhance the effectiveness of other antihypertensives. Of course, I happen to have a copy of the Essential Guide on my desk. There's a surprise. But if you look at possible risks, then there are potential water and electrolyte depletion with excessive or ongoing use, potential excessive potassium and magnesium loss. There's also a possible increase in blood sugar, possible decreased calcium level, some potential, very rare though again, blood cell disorders and or liver damage. And when you look at the overall spectrum, that's why in many senses calling into a radio program versus a good half an hour look at all the potential drug interactions, drug-food interactions, drug-disease interactions can be challenging. But what I try to do is to always give that sort of benefit-to-risk decision. And clearly, if you look at other medicines, good example of a medicine with side effects, some chemotherapy, some of the older ones, well, if the older targeted, or rather non-targeted, sort of selective toxicity-driven chemotherapy is a, sort of a complicated way of saying, well, cancers grow pretty fast, and those medicines are going to attack the cancer more than they're going to attack normal cells, except the ones that are rapidly growing, which happens to be your hair, some of the intestinal linings, and this is the reason you can get hair loss with some of the older chemotherapy agents, and you can also get some diarrhea and those sorts of syndromes because the medicine, again, is in general in your body, it's a systemic effect, and you're going to lose your hair. It will come back once the medicine in general, usually, when the medicine stopped or when that cycle of chemotherapy is over. But, you know, if you didn't know about that, that could be very frightening.
Well, that just raises the question about how side effects are researched. And we hear about, you know, doctors reporting it to the FDA and patients reporting it in the study that we opened the show with.
Yes.
But, you know, these drugs come on the market. At one point, they're new products. And we see these TV commercials, which can have long lists of side effects. How do researchers compile these lists?
So that's the real challenge. When you look at what happens, and there are actually four phases with that whole drug approval and then ongoing monitoring process. Phase one and two, generally in the lab, early research, and phase two in some people who are healthy volunteers, that's trying to figure out the dose and what happened. Phase three, we are actually looking at patients who are with the disease, who have the particular disease that's trying to be treated, and the medicines that they take. From that comes a body of evidence, if you will, that, well, if we have this new medicine, Ribacium, it looks like it's pretty safe in these people because we're trying to treat, let's say, high cholesterol with it. and it's eliminated by the liver, then you have to think, well, okay, how is it eliminated by the liver? And we should drill down a little further on that. The challenge becomes it's impossible to test ribacium in an FDA-required study of, let's say, 3,000 patients against all known medicines. And so what generally you see is a package insert that's developed that ribacium looks like it's removed by the liver. It appears that in a study of 3,000 patients that had these particular characteristics, these were the most prevalent side effects, and they were pretty close to really, really rare, and we didn't see anything as a serious potential side effect or adverse effect. So we think ribacium ought to go to market. And then once it goes to market, what happens is there's a phase four where these reports by physicians, pharmacists, nurse practitioners would start to come up. And/or studies would be done looking at comparative medicines, ribacium compared to, let's say, Lipitor. And they'd say, gee, what does this look like compared to that? And then you can get really a side-by-side look at both of the medicines and try to figure out then, if this one interacts with this and it's removed by the liver too, then what will ribacium do? Then you get a better handle of what's going on.
Well, could this data mining of the internet for patient reports be a phase five then in this process?
You see, I love that idea. And looking, or an augmented phase four, looking at that, and actually some medications that are brought to market, there's actually a fast track where medicines are used to be treating life-threatening illnesses can be brought to market sooner without all of the full research being done. And then it's presented to the FDA because we know, for example, if there's a cancer medicine, a medicine that's a breakthrough, works in a different way, can be fast-tracked by the FDA, and this brings patients who are otherwise going to die a new medicine to help treat this condition where it's shown to have a very strong beneficial effect. And the data then is mined later, but very clearly there are many layers that should be done, and we already mentioned the FDA Sentinel Initiative and this kind of data mining. Great ideas.
Well, I'm wondering also, because I think we've been talking about both just the side effects of a drug by itself, but also its interactions with other drugs. How much of the concern is over those interactions as opposed to just plain side effects by the drug itself?
I lose sleep over interactions. It's remarkable in that sense, looking at what may or may not interact and the kinds of things that come up later. If you look at something, just talking about side effects, Chantix or varenicline used to decrease smoking, well, as a potential side effect, which is very strange, people can have vivid dreams, and they're very, very, very intense dreams, which can be somewhat scary to patients. Well, that's something to be concerned about, but it isn't really life-threatening. The other challenge with that particular medicine is that you can also have suicidal ideation, and that's something that needs to be reported right away. Thinking sort of along the same lines with a mental status change, if you look at some antidepressants, generally the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, you can have the same sorts of things happen, and if there's any kind of suicidal ideation, thoughts about suicide, you need to talk to your family and your doctor about that right away. But it's something that is known can happen. And then if you look at potential drug interactions and you look at those, that becomes a little more challenging and tends to be elucidated a little bit later. An example that I think is important to mention, when we think about herbal products, we tend to think of them as natural and somewhat devoid of side effects, but it's very important to think about how they work. Let me give you an example there. For example, if you were prescribed Paxil for depression or any of the different antidepressants in that same family, which is how I tend to think of them, and you add on St. John's Wort thinking, well, yeah, this stuff looks like it has some data and looks like I can get this from the health food store. Well, the challenge is that the same transmitters, the serotonin that is increased beneficially by the Paxil, can also be increased by the St. John's wort. And if you get too much of it, it can lead to a serotonin syndrome, which actually is sort of an enhanced pharmacologic effect with the two medicines being used at the same time. And so what I always ask patients is, well, what prescription, non-prescription, herbal or nutraceutical medicines are you taking? And I always refer them as medicines because these extracts have gotten a lot stronger. And while that may need some strong benefits, it also means we need to be careful with them.
And I don't know, but nutritional supplements and herbal remedies, they don't usually have side effects, warnings of side effects on their labels, do they?
Well, and that's interesting. And so some will, some won't. The challenge with, and in some sense, sort of the ease of getting to market with those particular products, they're regulated under DSHEA, the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act, and this isn't the same sort of rigor that the FDA really holds pharmaceutical products to that are then prescribed. So very different. In Canada, it's actually a different story, and they actually have a lot more, and in Germany as well, with the German Commission e-monographs, a lot more rigor in the way they look at these products, and I think that's a better way to do it.
That would also come into the potency of one brand versus another.
Oh, my gosh. When you look at that, and that's another real challenge. If you look at, for example, going back to cholesterol, if you look at red rice yeast and those sorts of extracts, well, probably a well-formulated extract would have some compounds that are actually pretty similar to the HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors, the statins of the world, if you will, actually probably most similar to lovastatin. And it's interesting. I actually had a patient in Dallas where that happened, and they were very confused about why this gentleman was getting muscle cramps and having some problems and some real pains that just weren't going away on a very low dose of a statin-type medicine. And the clinical pharmacist who was there asking the questions came to my office and said, you know, I've got this really weird case, and this guy just doesn't have any reason to really have these problems. And I said, well, did you ask about herbals or nutraceuticals or anything else that he's getting from a health food store? He said, I'll be right back. Went back down to the clinic, and the wife was the one who talked about this. And the pharmacist said, well, tell me a little bit more about what else you're taking and what other kinds of things, you know, you add to your diet or any, have you ever gone to a health food store? And he says, well, yeah, I guess. And his wife goes, come on, tell him about that red rice stuff you're taking. And there it was, the red rice yeast. And it actually is like combining a higher dose of a statin-type medicine. And he happened to be one of those people who reacted to a lower dose with something called myositis, a muscle inflammation that the statins can cause, and certainly it's a rare effect, but up to about maybe 3% or so of people may have that reaction. It's something you have to be very careful of and follow, and you may actually need to change the medicine. So it's always the details, and it's always a great medication history versus, well, I've got 2 minutes, what are you taking? And then go on to the next patient.
Well, it's time for a short break, and we'll be back with more about prescription drugs and side effects with pharmacist Dr. James Rybacki. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and our topic today on Focus is prescription drug side effects and the quest to find out about those side effects as soon as possible before drugs are given out to patients. A new study indicates that checking patient comments on the Internet may work faster than waiting for doctors to report the problem. And my guest, a frequent guest on Focus over the years, is Dr. James Rybacki. He's the author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs. And if you go to essentialguidetoprescriptiondrugs.com, you will find some of his appearances on Focus and WILL linked to the website. We're flattered.
I tell you, it's something that I talked to David about, and I think those things are just great in the sense of the depth and the kinds of questions that typically we get on your program. And it's just remarkable just to be able to try to make that little bit of a difference and give a little bit of guidance. And you know, having said all that, we often think about side effects as bad things. And actually, by definition, a side effect is something that can be either therapeutic or adverse. And when you think about some medicines like that, it's probably interesting to talk about a couple of those. If you look at Obupropion, a medicine sold, we talked about antidepressants earlier, sold as Wellbutrin. Well, it's also a smoking cessation aid, and it's marketed there as Zyban. Perfect example, looking at older medicines, is an old high blood pressure medicine called minoxidil. Well, what do we know of that now? Well, the side effect that started to come out was, well, my gosh, some of these men are actually growing hair back when they're taking this. And so we got the topical Rogaine from that. And, you know, certainly in that sense, an interesting and positive effect. And it's always surprising to see how these things come up and what happens. But, again, it's something that changes almost daily. So it's certainly some job security, but it's challenging, as you mentioned, to keep up on. And I'm really excited about what may happen with the Internet search data mining that could give some signals earlier and then let the FDA drill down on what they're getting as reports and trying to figure out, gee, should we change the package insert on this or not? And certainly from my perspective, what should I change in the essential guide?
Well, one thing that struck me in what you just said are side effects previously unknown, which can actually be beneficial, at least in the right context. And the thought that drugs that are out there on the market right now may have other uses that we just haven't figured out yet.
Oh, definitely. And certainly in the same sense and in fair balance for herbal products, if you look at pharmacognosy and where some anticoagulants like warfarin came, these are actually roots and shoots, and these are natural products that were then identified in the sense of what their active ingredients are. There's one called acetyl salicylic acid that was by a gentleman named Bayer, which we would look at now and say Bayer, and then you'd say, oh my gosh, that's aspirin. And I am convinced if you tried to bring aspirin to market now, I actually put that in the latest essential guide to prescription drugs, 12 top meds then for 2012, but it'll also be in the 2013 that's upcoming. I think aspirin would be a prescription product because you have a lower dose very clearly and very efficaciously used as part of let's prevent a first or second heart attack in some higher risk patients. And in second heart attack in combination with some other medicines, for example, clopidogrel or Plavix, which actually in combination based on a study called the CURE trial, makes that particular medicine work better at preventing a heart attack. So, you know, very interesting in how they're used and how they all work together, but you have to know the biochemistry.
Well, we have some callers lined up
okay.
to ask their questions. So let's say hello to Ron in Decatur. And good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Yeah, a quick question. I'm curious why doctors aren't required to prescribe CoQ10 along with any statins that they prescribe, because CoQ10 is blocked by the liver by the same statin, or the production is blocked by the same statins that block the cholesterol production.
Now we're going to biochemistry. And if you look at it, that's actually something that I very firmly believe in. The same pathway, and you are actually spot on with this, that any particular statin, Lipitor, Zocor, any of them works against Crestor as well. That same pathway also forms ubiquinone or CoQ10, as it's more commonly known. And it's something that I have always advocated. If you can interfere with something, and if you look at that, the statins in general, if you look at their potential adverse effects, some mental status changes and some energy changes are right up there, as well as some blood sugar changes as well. And probably some of those mental status changes, some confusion that can happen with a particular family of medicines. And some of the, there have been some small reports about beneficial effects with the myositis and CoQ10, but there's no question that the energy pieces are probably an effect of the medicine on a pathway that wasn't intended. So you're exactly right. I always recommend adding back a well-formulated CoQ10 when people are taking a statin. And in general, I would love to see a large study of that. But in general, and I'll admit anecdotally, I think there's a benefit or an avoidance of possible side effects when you do that. That's a very brilliant, astute question.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. And, Doctor, do you think this is worth asking your doctor about if you're taking statins?
I do. I really, really do. And actually, in the 12 top meds for 2012, and in the statin section, I have a series of do's and don'ts, and that's actually in there about adding back a CoQ10, a well-formulated one from a reputable company. That's something that, yeah, talk to your doctor. Should I add this back? I heard about this. And does that make sense for me? Absolutely. Well,
okay. Let's go to our next caller. I want to say good morning to Marlene in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you. I have sort of a two-part query question.
Okay.
And it does involve what you were just speaking about. One is the role of pharmacology or pharmacists when it comes to your general medical team. It seems to me that we need to have doctors that are working more closely with pharmacists directly when they do prescribe. And I have noticed that even though we have wonderful computer systems, and every time I go to the doctor, they take all my medical history and all my vitamins.
Good.
But no flashes come up. The doctor will consistently try to prescribe penicillin, even though I have a penicillin allergy. So it seems to me that the computer system ought to be able to flash up some kind of things. I have a lot of problems. And my husband also had trouble with taking synthetic Synthroid.
Wow.
You know, and it was doing nothing. And when the minute he changed to the brand name, he had improvement. So all of these things make it difficult. And I think maybe a pharmacologist or something involved in the team closely would be better. What is your feeling?
Well, obviously, I would admit to being biased since I do hold a doctorate in pharmacy. But having done that and rounded for many, many, in some sense, very focused learning experience years as part of an interdisciplinary team, it's very common to see pharmacists rounding at academic medical centers with a particular team, a medicine team, certainly a transplant team, and really, in my opinion, making a difference. Where I've actually gone in and been an interim director of pharmacy, I have so strongly advocated getting pharmacists out on the floors, making rounds, being part of the team. And there's a lot of data to say, you know, you avoid a lot of drug interactions. You certainly look at some cost versus outcomes issues and generally get some better results or outcomes, certainly longer term. Looking at the data, absolutely very, very positive. And I've also done this in community hospitals saying, well, no. If we look at this, we're going to have to resource it and give this person the free time to have 4 hours for rounding and the other 4 hours of this shift for some dispensing functions, but I think that's a great idea. Back to computers, though, you've hit a really specialized focus with your question, and there's something called alert fatigue. And what generally happens in hospitals, if you look at Meditech, Cerner, those sorts of, there's usually a big three in hospital computer programs, there are adverse effects and interactions, alerts that come up, but there's always that balance, and what the drug information and medication safety pharmacist, where they have them, would always struggle with is, well, geez, this is a mild side effect. I'm not sure we can alert to that, but let's go with moderate and above in those particular interactions, and certainly in the sense of allergies, which you very astutely brought up. One of the things that is very challenging, and folks at the Joint Commission for Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, TJC as they now call themselves, have looked at as well, how complete are your allergy profiles? And it may not go system to system and hospital to hospital, and so that allergy that you have may not pop up. That's frightening.
Yes.
The way that they're trying to deal with this is something that some patients have complained about. It's called admission medication reconciliation and discharge medication reconciliation. What that means is that someone, probably in the emergency room, and then probably another person, usually a nurse, will ask on the floor, well, what medicines are you taking and what allergies do you have? And that's a crucial thing to pay attention to. You really have to get good information. Great question, though.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. We have a question here from Ron from Muncie who emailed. Can you recommend a website where you could just put in your meds and see a list of interaction concerns?
Actually, I'd advocate a two-step focus. A couple of things. Medscape has one, and drugs.com has one. But again, back to the pharmacist and utilizing where you're getting your prescription filled. From that point in the hospital where all your medicines come in, it's fair and reasonable. Ask the nurse, hey, could the pharmacist and the pharmacy team run a drug interactions check for these medicines, please? Usually that would come up in your profile anyway. But if you ask that specifically and make use of that clinical pharmacist that may be there, could the pharmacist come up to the floor and talk to me about that? They will, in general, use something called Micromedics or UpToDate or a couple of the other drug interactions and drug information software pieces that really can drill down in a lot of detail, and you can actually help them and help them help you and educate a little bit more on possible interactions.
So you're saying start at the doctor's office.
I really do. And then wherever you're getting your prescriptions filled, ask there as well and make sure you include all of your medicines you take sometimes, PRN if you will, medicines you take on an ongoing basis, and non-prescription nutraceutical products, because they can really have a big impact.
Well, it does sound like, though, that you would not, there's no website that you could just go on by yourself that you would is reliable.
Drugs.com has, with some disclaimers there, about there's both a professional and a consumer side, and you can put in particular possible interactions and see what happens, and they characterize, though, and do a pretty good job. Medscape also has one, so there's two. The other possibility is looking at FDA and see if there are any reports there. And then the other possible research piece is clinicaltrials.gov.
Let's go to another caller, and Lou from Urbana, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, I have some of the same reactions to synthetic Synthroid as the one before. And I don't have them with a regular Synthroid. But my question is that a family member some years ago took a Metoprolol.
Wait, say that again?
For blood pressure.
Okay, how do you spell that?
Metropol.
Okay, Metoprolol. That's a beta blocker family that actually sort of blocks some of the effects of adrenaline.
She kept increasing the dosage. And one day she called me very confused. She was just fine in the morning when we left home. And finally it was determined, although they couldn't take her off of it for a while, that this had really messed her up in many different ways. She was an intelligent person who had held high offices in administration, and she's never quite gotten back to her old self.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. That's a tremendous challenge with a side effect of a medicine. The first question I would ask is, how low did her blood pressure go, and did they ever mention that she could have had a possible stroke from her blood pressure going too low?
They never said that. The only thing the doctor said is we slowed her down too much.
Okay, so slowing her down too much could also be an effect on the heart. And so the challenge with these medicines, when you look at it, beta blockers in general, they really block that effect of adrenaline. And so the side effect of that is a slowing of the heart rate. That's actually used beneficially. Metoprolol is one widely used after a heart attack. And the way to typically think about that is, well, that's going to give the heart a little bit of a rest. It's going to slow the heart rate down, and since the heart's been damaged by the heart attack, that's actually part of the evidence-based medicine that says, you know, after a heart attack, a beta blocker is clearly indicated. Now, the challenge, and if you look at any of the high blood pressure profiles in the Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, what I talk about is in patients who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s, who may be more sensitive to blood pressure lowering, you have to be very careful about the degree to which you lower the blood pressure and the speed that you lower the blood pressure, because those effects there, clearly, as you put it, slowing down too much, that's an effect on the heart, and that means the circulation to the brain and to the heart itself may not be what they should be.
Well, she never has been the same after that, though.
And that says to me, if you look at the half-life of those medicines, even with a Toprol XL, which is the extended release form, those generally would be out of your body in 4.32 half-lives. So if you look at that and looking at the half-life itself, you'd expect in, you know, a week the effect would be gone. So that says there may have been, and that's something you should talk to your doctor about.
Well, you know, she was under the doctor's care, and he
right.
knew this went on, and they never found anything else.
Yeah, and that's remarkable. There's certainly, with beta blockers in general, they can cause a mental depression.
Has happened.
and that's infrequent, but in general, there's a feeling, well, I'm kind of tired, and, you know, I'm not so sure about that. There's some effects on blood pressure that are possible, more likely in type 2 diabetics, but it sounds like that effect may have been circulatory and may have actually done some damage. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for calling. This is nothing to take lightly, the risks and potential benefits that are here when we talk about side effects.
Oh, clearly, and you know, looking at that, there's no that's actually a pharmacologic extension effect, and what the caller was mentioning was that they kept on increasing the dose, and it's important, imperative to make sure that you've given that change in dose time to reach its peak effect. Some effects are a little bit delayed, and for example, you know, if you look at that particular drug, metoprolol, doses should be increased gradually and generally intervals of 7 to 10 days, depending on how severe the blood pressure is and or in combination with other medicines. And if you make a change too soon and you haven't seen the peak effect, then you may be more likely to get side effects. Another good example there are medicines for depression. Generally, you start low and go slow, especially in older patients. And titrating up, that is increasing the dose, generally should happen slowly, because it may be a couple weeks before you see, 3 weeks, even a month with some antidepressants before you see that peak effect. And that's something to be careful of.
Well, we're just in about the last minute of the program here. And just some good rules of thumb, hoping that that the reporting process can be improved. What do patients need to be aware of and to keep in mind when they're prescribed medications?
I think I've always addressed these as do's and don'ts, and it's always crucial to talk to your doctor when you get a new prescription about what the expectation is. You need to set a target for the particular medicine, when you should see the benefits, and what are the particular risks that may come up. What I've done in the 12 top meds for 2012 is to actually say 9 or 10 or 8 important things you should know while taking this medicine. I think you should carry a card in your purse or wallet that lists your current diagnosis and the medicines you're taking. Some patients and systems actually have those on a flash drive. And should you lose consciousness or be in a car accident, that's a great way then to have your medications right there and somebody can look at them. If you have any, and this is specific to the medicines themselves, if you have any changes in vision, short-term memory, those sorts of changes, muscle pain or tenderness, and, for example, with the statins, you need to call your doctor and ask about that. If you look at potential side effects and ask your doctor, well, what are the potential side effects of this medicine? Are there any delayed side effects, and what should I do if I start to have them? If you are a stroke patient or a heart attack patient, you need to ask, well, if these symptoms start to happen again, what should I do? Some patients would be advocated, depending on what the stroke was or the heart attack, well, to have some aspirin there and call 911 and take the aspirin and actually chew it. But you need to talk to your doctor about that. Always think ahead. If you're thinking you're having an adverse effect, 911 is a better place. If you're having chest pain, then FDA MedWatch. If you're having a poison emergency, there's a great national number, 800-222-1222, where you can get accidental poisoning information from experts. Always go to the expert.
And with that, we're out of time. Dr. James Rabacki, author of The Essential Guide to Prescription Drugs, thanks for being with us on Focus.
My pleasure.